Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. As you've come to expect, because we are doing this by Zoom and everyone is social distancing and everything is remote, one, expect mistakes. Expect people to maybe fade in and out, but hopefully this will be incredibly professional. But more importantly, we tape this on Monday afternoon, and you will hear it at noon on Tuesday or around the country on Pacifica whenever you pick up our show. But before we begin with our interview of our two guests, I want to remind everyone that we begin our show every single day with the powerful words of Colonel Vindman in November of 2019 when he was testifying before the impeachment hearing. And I read an article at The Atlantic, and it was from about sometime in February. And the article said, here was Colonel Vindman's mistake. He exhibited and performed the crime of doing the right thing, of doing the right thing. So now we will hear the words of Colonel Vindman. And as he assures his father, it will be okay. What we all have come to expect is that it was not okay for him, and clearly it's not okay for the rest of us. So I urge you to vote in November of 2020 with his words and his voice ringing in your head.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States, so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Okay. Before I introduce my guests, one I've had on fairly regularly, the other one is new to me, I saw a piece at The Intercept, and it was from late March, and it was entitled, Two Florida Poll Workers Have Tested Positive for the novel coronavirus since the March 17th primary, which was held contrary to guidance from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention against large gatherings, which might in fact help to curb the spread of the coronavirus. Both of the workers were stationed at polls in Broward County in the southeast part of the state. A spokesperson for the Broward County Supervisor of Elections said on Thursday that all 16 poll workers who worked alongside the workers who tested positive have been contacted by the supervisor's office. Election officials are also advising anyone who might have voted at those locations, both in the city of Hollywood, to take appropriate steps and seek medical advice. Oh, no surprise. Well, that makes our next two guests even more important. We're being joined by Amy Sherman. She's a staff writer with PolitiFact based, guess where, in South Florida. And she was part of the team that launched PolitiFact Florida in 2010. Also joining us is a fairly regular voice. Louis Jacobson has been with PolitiFact since 2009 and is currently a senior correspondent. Previously, he served as the deputy editor of Roll Call and as founding editor of the Legislative Wire Service, Congress Now. He has written for so many other places, and we've contacted him in so many other ways, Lou. Welcome back, my old friend. Welcome my new friend, Amy. So your piece, there are two pieces, and they actually go together. One, Amy, you co-authored. The other one was written by Lou. But the first piece was, will COVID-19 force a massive absentee vote in the November election? So I'm going to start with you, Amy, because you co-authored this with Lou, and Lou's going to have to do a little bit of a heavy lift since the other piece was written by him by himself. So let's talk about this challenge. I think I started with the two poll workers who came down with COVID-19. And there was concern even going into that vote, whether the DNC should have stopped it, whether state the state governments should have stopped it, whether the local Democratic Party should have stopped it. But of course, we're so into this voting procedure that we couldn't imagine the extent of what COVID-19 would mean. But now that we do, tell me a little bit about the article and what are you seeing going forward?
Well, what I'm seeing at this point is basically it's on the mind of every county election supervisor in Florida about how to handle an expected ramp up of absentee ballot voting. And this is going to come before November because Florida does have some primaries in August. So they're really in the full swing of planning right now. I would say that in some counties where absentee ballot voting is already very common, this big ramp up isn't as huge of a monumental task as it is in some other counties, such as Broward, where it's not the preferred method. In Broward, more voters prefer to go in person to vote, whether it's early voting or on election day.
Can you explain that to me? Why is one county more, I'll put a stamp on it and mail it, and why is another county feeling like they somehow have to exert themselves and have a physical presence and they need to check the box or pull the lever? Is there something about the counties? How are they different? Is it a demographic? Is it, I'm just kind of curious as to why.
Yeah, I mean, there are laws that say how voting works, but then there's a lot of power left to the individual county supervisors, and it's really up to them if they want to market or push one method of voting more than another. So in Pinellas, the staff told me that their supervisor started to push absentee voting in 2010. And her rationale was it would save her money after the 2008 economic downturn. Other counties, Broward, a huge Democratic county in Florida, just has a tradition of people show up to vote. And, you know, there are big crowds and there's people waving signs. And the folks in Broward just like to show up to vote. So it's going to be more of a sea change for them if there's this massive drive to vote by mail. And Democratic activists, including the DNC, are now pushing really hard in Florida. They're going to be sending text messages to loads of voters urging them to sign up to get an absentee ballot.
Okay, now
what about Miami-Dade, Amy? Miami-Dade is the biggest, isn't it?
Miami-Dade and Broward both have the highest numbers of Democratic voters. I did not check today before the show to see who is ahead, but it's always proportionally Broward has this huge percentage of Democratic voters, though the no party affiliation voters have also been growing.
So Lou, I'm going to now toss to you. What I love about PolitiFact is not only do you focus on issues that are so important, and you give us this laundry list of places where you went to find the content. So no. I feel like I'm reading a paper from high school, you know? You had to. So thank you very much, because I actually started to look through where you went, because that also gives me good information as to where I would want to go for additional support and maybe hearing different voices. But the other thing that you do at PolitiFact, and we're going to post this on Facebook tomorrow, is that you give us the Cliff Note version, and mm-hmm. then you give us the whole piece. And so you call it "If Your Time Is Short," and everybody has that. So let's talk, Lou, a little bit about the snapshot now, because mm-hmm. you know, when you think about elections, it's not really controlled by the feds. It's mm-hmm. controlled by the states. And even mm-hmm. though it's sometimes controlled by the states, in some places it's controlled by the counties, and sometimes it's controlled by the towns. So it really is, it's their fiefdom, all right? Yes. And they get to sort of dictate what to do. So moving into the potential of some kind of mail balloting, which is what you suggest could be the solution, and frankly, I think it is the only solution. Technology mm-hmm. won't allow us to do it. I think, one, people are concerned about hacking, but a lot of people don't have access to technology. Right. So it would be outrageous to do this. But let's talk about what the picture looks like today, where we already have mail ballot. So we understand it's been done and it's effective. And we could also look at, if you don't have mail balloting, what about this absentee stuff? Do you need to have use or not? And then we can move into what are the potential choices going forward.
Definitely. Yeah. When you post a link to our story, it'll have a nice little map, color-coded map of the U.S. Yeah. there that'll explain everything I'm saying now.
Perfect.
There are five states that have all mail balloting now. So they've already implemented this. Right. No one goes to a center. Typically, you can drop off your ballot at a drop-off center, but it's not a typical voting place like you would go in and actually cast your ballot. All you do is drop it off. Mm-hmm. So Washington State, Oregon, Utah, Colorado, and Hawaii. Those are the five states that already do this.
Okay. Back to something. You mentioned the drop-off place. So that's in lieu of a stamp and an envelope? You can just put it into the drop-off place?
It might vary from state to state, but I think that that's probably an option. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I think a lot of people do that because they're slow to do it and finally get on it, you know, on election day or whatever, and then like drive off and drop it off at the.
Okay.
So then there are three other states where counties can choose to do all mail, and a lot of them have. Two small states, North Dakota, Nebraska, but then the biggie is California.
Okay.
And I think California is really moving towards doing it statewide. So they'll probably be in that first group of six soon, next couple of cycles. And then there's a whole bunch of other states, about 20 states, I'm guessing, that have no excuse absentee ballots. What that means is that all you got to do is just request either online or by phone or in person an absentee ballot at weeks before the election takes place, and they'll give it to you, no questions asked. So those sorts of places might have some challenges in terms of dealing with reading and counting a mm-hmm. large upsurge mm-hmm. in those mail ballots, but it's not that big a deal because they already have it on the books. It's part of the law that if you want a mail ballot, you can get a mail ballot.
So it sounds like it's mail ballot light.
Yes.
Okay.
And so those places will still have a full suite of polling places to go in person on election day, in a lot of cases, it's a fairly high percentage of votes that are cast by mail. Then you have 16 or 17 states. It's mostly a swath across, like from Texas east through most of the South, except for Georgia and North Carolina, mm-hmm. Some in the Midwest, Indiana, and then some of the Northeastern states, New York, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. These are states where it's excuse only.
Excuse only. COVID-19. What incredible excuse. Right. I mean, I can't imagine it. How do I shelter in place and still show up and vote? You know, I mean,
right. So now it's possible that these states either legislatively or by order of the election outfit, the state government office might just say, okay, we're going to loosen our restrictions on what the excuse is so broadly that basically anybody qualifies.
Right, exactly.
That state by state, there may be legal issues they have to get around. But I mean, typically right now, it wouldn't be good enough to say, I'm scared of getting infected by going out, in terms of the actual laws as they are now. So that would have to be somehow changed, either regulatorily or legislatively.
Okay. So I'm listening to this, Amy, and I'm thinking, okay. You're mentioning what they do now in Florida. We're hearing from Lou about the states that have this buckshot approach. Again, you can see this is federalism at its best, the new federalism. Every state does its own thing. Even if you wanted to move into universal mail-in voting, I think there would be kind of a cost here, because you would have the cost of the little postcard or whatever it is you got to fill out. You got the stamp issue. Maybe we could sort of waive it because it's the U.S. Postal Service or a Dropbox. But then you've got all the people that have to count it. I mean, I'm thinking about my state, and what you will love is we only have a state of 1.3 million people, right? But we have 400 legislators. So we elect them every 2 years. And then we go through something where we have contested elections because there's these little tiny districts. And I mean, we're spending hours and hours and hours in a state of 1.3. What the hell do you do in Florida? And what does it mean for some of the big states? Because to me, it sounds like there's safety from the perspective of the voter, but how do you collect and then ramp up to actually produce results?
Right. Well, you know, at this point, when I talk to county supervisors in Florida, they are assuming that they're still going to have to offer early voting, election day voting, and absentee ballot voting, because the counties can't on their own say, boom, it's a mail-in election only. That would require a change in state law, and our legislature is already done for the year. So that's really why, you know, they think this is going to be expensive, because they expect a massive ramp up of absentee balloting, but then they also still have to staff and plan for early voting centers and election day voting. And supervisors told me, you know, it's not just like dumping a bunch of extra ballots in the mail, like you're sending out invitations to your wedding. They said there's a lot of factors to consider and a lot of different entities they're going to have to work with. First one, the post office. They can't do a massive, massive dump. They're going to have to stagger it. Well, how do you stagger it? They're going to have to find vendors that can really ramp up and do extra prints of ballots and the envelopes that the supervisor sends you, your ballot, and then that inside envelope that you send it back in. So they have to find vendors who can do that. Then they're going to have the staff that can deal with all the absentee ballot requests and deal with getting all the ballots back in. So they say, you know, this is going to take more money on their part.
Okay, Ken, you wanted to weigh
just
in?
Just to say,
yes,
on that
could I
point,
follow up?
Ken, weigh in.
I just wanted to follow up on that question, because Arnie asked about costs, and Amy, that's what you were talking about, and you're thinking about dollar costs. But what about the costs in terms of the integrity of the election? I worry about the risk that if everybody is mailing in votes and nobody's going to the polls, I mean, think about how we have poll watchers. I've been a voter protection lawyer, you know, in a multitude of elections to make sure that there's no funny business going on. And if everybody's voting, who knows if Mary Schmidt in California is sending in a million Republican ballots. It's hard to monitor the integrity of that.
Let me go to Lou, because Lou, you mentioned that there are already five states that do that. So the issue of, has it worked? What's been the problem? What about the integrity? I mean, if nothing else, at least we have empirical data. That's important to me. So tell me a little bit about those states that already do it.
Yeah, so the feedback I've generally heard is pretty good. A couple of these states, Utah, Colorado, are doing it for the first time in this cycle. So we don't have that long a track record. California, though, as well as the states of Washington and Oregon, have been doing it for a couple cycles now. And, you know, except for the issue, which is, you know, annoying to political types like us, which is that it takes days and days to get a winner because all the mail is still arriving.
The suspense. Exactly.
Right. Setting that aside, I don't get the sense that there's been a lot of negative sort of procedural problems. What I will say is that there are two significant issues that could cast into doubt the sort of reliability of the vote. One, as you said, is fraud. Most experts say that in general, there is not too much ballot fraud. And it's been used, of course, to do things like voter ID laws.
Right.
But to the extent where there is fraud, it actually has tended to be in the mail balloting realm, not the in-person balloting realm. So that is a legitimate issue to be concerned about. Probably even a bigger issue, though, are what are sometimes called spoiled ballots or rejected ballots. These are things where the person filling them out has done something wrong, filled out like an incorrect address, or marked the ballot in a way that can't be read, or it gets torn or whatever. So this is not much of a problem when you have in-person voting, because you have a poll worker there who can help a person through and fill it out right. So there probably will be a larger percentage of these ballots that are taken out of the count because there's some problem with them. And that's not a partisan thing. It could be anybody doing that.
Right, right. So I have a question for both Amy and for Lou. And that is, have we figured out what the cost would be? I know that they put some money into the bailout bill or the stimulus bill, whatever you want to call that bill. And I know it wasn't very much, more than what they started.
$400 million.
Well, that could be used in one state, like New York or California. So right. I guess I'm trying to figure out is, has any economist sat down and at least did a spreadsheet and said, this is what I think it will cost? And the reason I even asked this question is, so we air in Houston, Texas, and we've been trained very well by a guy named Scott Braddock, who's the editor of a political newsletter called The Quorum Report. One of the things I've learned is that the ballots in Texas can go on and on and on because you have these judges and these county people and whatever. I mean, there are a lot of people that you have to sort of check the box for. Imagine the size of that envelope. I mean, it's like, I mean, in New Hampshire, it'll be kind of a postcard, but I'm thinking about places like Texas. Holy moly, Texas is already kind of too parsimonious to start, and they kind of love voter suppression, but on top of this, it's going to cost a fortune, Lou. And who's going to pay for it, I guess, is the question. Are they going to divide the cost up, or are they going to send the bill to the feds?
I suspect they will send the bill to the feds. I do see that Amy Klobuchar and Ron Wyden, two Democratic senators, put forth a bill that would move to an all-male voting for this fall. And it does appear that they had sought $325 million. So that's sort of in the ballpark for what the stimulus bill has in it, $400 million. I don't know whether that's considered to be enough or whether that's just a starting bid or what. But I do think $400 million could go a long way. Especially because a lot of these states already have the systems in place. They just have to ramp up their ability to do it for a larger percentage of the
vote. Okay, so Amy, we talked about the fact at the very beginning of the show that this is kind of like, this is the Federalist idea. States get to decide the voting things, and then you got all the little fiefdoms and the counties and the cities and towns. And so, you know, everyone's got their hand up going, I'm in charge. What about Congress? Can they just walk in and write a law and say, oh, you boys, you know, you used to do this, but we're living in a new time. COVID-19 has changed everything. I am going to tell you now that you all have to observe the following set of rules. Do they have the authority to do that?
I'm going to defer to Lou on that question, but I would say a lot of election management really starts at the county level. So in South Florida, I would be paying attention to right now. It's the time of year where election supervisors are starting to probably contact county commissioners with new budget requests.
Yeah.
And at least maybe they'll get reimbursed later by the feds, but I think they have to do their own financial planning right now. When we were reporting last week, I did not hear any supervisor pinpoint a specific dollar figure, and they probably don't want to do that yet. But one supervisor did tell me that she thinks absentee ballot requests are going to triple or quadruple. Mm-hmm. That in itself is going to be an expense. Mm-hmm. I would anticipate they could end up with much higher costs than they did in 2016.
So Lou, I was a legislator when they passed in Congress the motor voter law. And that seemed to be something that was a demand by Congress that we all sort of genuflect and play by the rules. I think my state, however, got out of that because they were able to say, we're the exception to the rule. Can we do same day registration instead of motor voter? And we were one of, I think, one or two states that was able to get out from under. But it does suggest that what Amy Klobuchar wants to do with this, you know, mail-in balloting is that she doesn't want it to be, you know, a county gets to opt in or a state gets to opt in. She wants to see all 50 states doing it simultaneously.
Right. So I think the federal government does have sway, not 100% sway, but the most important thing the federal government can do is to leverage the money it gives. So basically, if it's going to shell out dollars, it'll say you have to do it, do X, Y, and Z. And if you don't do X, Y, and Z, you won't get the money. So that should probably be able to be enough to corral most jurisdictions into this. Maybe not all, but it should be a lot.
Yeah, money is a persuader. I'm pretty sure that. All right. So real quickly before we let you go, we only have like 3 minutes left. But Lou, I got to just at least get 3 minutes of you on that second article about the primary. What the hell is going to happen? And we still have Bernie and Biden. We still have a number of primaries that have been either delayed or will not be happening till later. And then, of course, we have the big convention. Yep. So what are we hearing?
Okay, so actually, funny you mentioned this, I have a piece coming out tomorrow about the conventions.
Oh, good.
So you'll be getting that. First, on the primaries, we've had a lot of states shift their primaries to be later in the cycle, including a couple, especially New York, which is actually after the date where you're supposed to have all your delegates completed and sent to the DNC. It's now going to be 3 weeks after that. Now, that's not...
Wow.
All the DNC has to do is just change the date. That's not that hard to do.
Right.
But it does just sort of, you know, paint a picture for how compressed the schedule is, because all these states need time to stand up their systems to do either do all mail or to have a breather by the time, you know, 2 months from now when things are a little bit better, perhaps.
Yeah.
So that bumps up right against the schedule for the convention, which is in July.
In Milwaukee.
Right. And with 50,000 people.
Social distance that, you know,
if you get it down to the 5,000 or so delegates, you're still going to have people, that's like 5,000 people, going through transportation hubs and eating in restaurants and everything. It's going to be a challenge unless things turn around pretty quickly. If I had to bet today, I would think that there's going to be some sort of online equivalent, at least for the Democrats. Now, the GOP has their convention in August. It's about 5 or 6 weeks later. So they have more time to figure this out. But the Democrats are on a real tight timeline. People who I was talking to said they're drop dead for either sort of fish or cut bait. It seems to be about June 1st.
Wow.
You might know before that.
Okay. Lou Jacobson. Amy Sherman, PolitiFact, thank you so much for joining us. I have a funny feeling we're going to be calling you a lot because things won't necessarily even be evolving. They'll be devolving, I think, is what's going to happen.
Exactly.
So thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. All right, everyone, stick around. A little Climate Connections is next. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. It's a good time to be a bug and a bad time to be a tree. That's according to Jeff Hickey of the University of Idaho. Based on aerial surveys, he estimates that since 1997, bark beetles have killed more than 5% of the forested area in the western United States. And global warming is likely to make the problem worse. Hickey says that droughts in the Northwest can leave trees stressed and more vulnerable to attack. Meanwhile, rising temperatures can make the beetles more numerous.
For mountain pine beetle, which is the most damaging of the bark beetle species in western North America, we expect warming to reduce beetle mortality during wintertime.
Warming also speeds up the development of insects so that more generations of the beetles can be born each year. And like something out of a horror movie, when more beetles emerge at the same time, they can mount mass attacks that overwhelm a tree's natural defenses.
Temperature will allow populations to synchronize within a stand, emerge, and move to the next tree to attack it more successfully.
So climate change could lead to even more bark beetle outbreaks in already stressed western forests. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1969. That was the day Dr. Ralph Abernathy, president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, arrived in Charleston, South Carolina, to address striking hospital workers and their supporters. More than 400 black hospital workers at Medical College Hospital and Charleston County Hospital had walked off the job earlier in the month. They demanded an end to racial harassment and discrimination, wage increases, union recognition, and the reinstatement of fired co-workers. It was yet another instance where workers' struggles embodied the broader social debates of the day. Struggles for racial and gender equality, as well as the rights of public sector workers to organize, especially in the South, all converged in Charleston. Workers at both hospitals sought out Local 1199, which had already organized hospital workers in New York City. Local 1199B was soon chartered, and Mary Moultrie, a licensed nurse from Medical College Hospital, was elected president. 12 workers were fired when the new union demanded recognition. That's when they voted to go on strike. Picketers were met with injunctions and arrests. The president of MCH, William McCord, stated that he would not, quote, turn a $25 million complex over to a bunch of people who don't have a grammar school education. He and Governor Robert McNair cited the state's right to work law as justification for refusal to recognize the union. The SCLC arrived in Charleston to lend its support. Speaking to 1,500 workers and their supporters, Abernathy linked the struggles of Local 1199B to those of meat packers and sanitation workers. He also charged that Congress would rather spend millions on war than to stand people on their feet in Charleston. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Sulfur dioxide, hello, carbon monoxide, the air is everywhere. Breathe deep while you sleep, breathe deep, bless you, alcohol, bloodstream, save me, nicotine, lung steam, incense, incense is in the air. Breathe deep while you sleep. Ectoplasm, fallout, atomic orgasm, vapor and fume at the stone of my tomb, breathing like a sullen perfume, eating at the stone of my tomb. Welcome, sulfur dioxide, hello, carbon monoxide, the air is everywhere.
Welcome back to part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude, taped by Zoom on Monday afternoon. Couple of reasons I really am glad that Jamie Smith Hopkins is a reporter, both at the Center for Public Integrity, and also this story appeared, I believe it was in Mother Jones. And it's about environmental degradation, it's about pollution, and it also looks at the overlay of COVID-19 on these significant problems. But before I bring Jamie on to talk about her piece, Your City's Air Pollution Could Make COVID-19 Even More Dangerous, and the subtitle, Even Before the Global Pandemic, Pollution Made It Harder for Some to Breathe. As I was getting ready to interview her about her piece at Mother Jones and the Center for Public Integrity, I noticed a piece that just came out at The Hill. And according to Jamie, it came out literally right after she had filed her piece, so she is very aware of this. And the title of it at The Hill was, EPA suspends enforcement of environmental laws amid coronavirus. Oh my God. Any excuse to suspend enforcement of environmental laws. And I'm just going to really quickly, Jamie, please forgive me, just read a couple of sentences from the article at The Hill, and then we're going to take this and sort of blend it in with your piece at Mother Jones. The EPA issued a sweeping, this is the most important word, sweeping suspension of its enforcement of environmental laws Thursday, that's last week, telling companies they would not need to meet environmental standards during the coronavirus outbreak. The quote-unquote temporary policy, for which the EPA has set no end date, note no end date, would allow any number of industries to skirt environmental laws, with the agency saying it will not, quote, seek penalties for non-compliance with routine monitoring and reporting obligations. Cynthia Giles, who headed the EPA's Office of Enforcement during the Obama administration, called it a moratorium on enforcing the nation's environmental laws and, quote, an abdication of the agency's duty. Two more sentences, and then Jamie, the podium is yours. Quote, this EPA statement is essentially a nationwide waiver of environmental rules for the indefinite future. It tells companies across the country that they will not face enforcement even if they admit unlawful air and water pollution in violation of an environmental laws, so long as they, quote, claim that those failures are in some ways caused by the virus pandemic, and allows them an out on monitoring too, so we may never know how bad the violating pollution was. And what she said, Jamie, was never, never have they seen anything like this. But of course, this is Donald Trump's EPA. And when you look at the people he put in place, it doesn't surprise me. They were looking for any excuse to roll back environmental laws. Coronavirus just popped up first. Welcome to the program. How are you?
Thanks for having me on.
So your piece at Mother Jones is really important because we know that this coronavirus hits different people differently. We know that age is important. A pre-existing condition, especially something like asthma or something that involves your lungs, means that you are ripe to both struggle through COVID-19 and you've upped your ability to die from COVID-19. And given now the fact that we don't have enough ventilators and you may be getting online and they may be triaging and having a do not resuscitate. I mean, we're living in a time we can't even imagine. The calamity of pollution is even intensified even more. So talk to me about, you know, this connection and what you noticed, because you actually talked to a number of people who have experienced this and are terrified.
Well, again, thanks for having me on. One thing I should say is I'm a reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. And so I wrote the story for my newsroom and we co-published with Mother Jones.
Great.
So glad that they did that. They certainly understand the impact of air pollution. So what I did was take a look. This is something that's well understood by researchers. Decades of research suggests that air pollution can impact your health. And there's a lot of research too that looks at how air pollution can impact your ability to fight off other things, to fight off infection, for instance. And it's not a helpful factor, as you might guess. I talked to researchers in particular who had looked at the impact of air pollution in 1918 during that influenza pandemic.
Spanish and they specifically, flu.
Yeah, it was a really smart idea. And there wasn't much air monitoring at that time, as you might expect. It was a long time ago. But they were able to look at how much coal a number of cities in the U.S., 180, were burning. And they compared the cities with more coal burning to the cities with less, and found that the cities burning more coal had more deaths, more excess yeah. deaths than the cities yeah. that had less. And so the good news is that we've got, in many cities, you know, that were using a lot of coal in those days, there's a lot less pollution now. So that's good. But the bad news is that research keeps finding that air pollution affects your health at lower and lower levels. And some people are breathing much worse air than other people, depending on where they live.
Well, but Jamie, and you know, back then it was coal. We've gotten a lot more sophisticated. Now we burn lots of crap. You know, there's so much toxicity going into the air now because you've got oil refineries, you've got gas, you've got fracking, you've got this, you've got chemical plants, you've got everything. I mean, Houston had a fire. I mean, the fire from one of the chemical plants that blew up. So not only do you have to worry about being close to a chemical plant, but then you have to worry about a fire, and then the fire goes on forever and adds more pollutants to the air. So yes, less coal. Yes, we've done some cleanup. Now you hear that the EPA is talking about suspending the kind of monitoring that they're supposed to do. And we've gotten better, but in a way, we may also have created even greater sort of intensity of pockets of places, like places in Texas, like places in Louisiana, like maybe even places in New Jersey, where you have to really worry about air quality. And just living in an urban environment, like a New York City, with so much traffic, that too is a pollutant. And that makes places like New York and Chicago so vulnerable to this.
Yeah, in fact, even just comparing sort of the now versus 1918, New York was one of those higher risk cities in 1918. And it's still relatively, compared to the US, in the higher pollution category. And the thing is, I mean, there's some areas that are pretty well monitored for certain kinds of pollutants like ozone or fine particles. But you know, there's just not nearly enough air monitors across the US to tell us exactly what we're breathing. And some areas don't have any monitors at all. And so that makes it really challenging to tell, you know, how clean is their air really.
Well, you know, as I was reading this, I sent the story off to my daughter who lives in Shanghai. And one of the interesting things about COVID-19 is that when you see people in China, even before COVID-19, everybody was wearing masks. I mean, it's like jewelry, you know, it's like everyone has their mask and they have their outfit and they go out to. And people thought, how strange the Chinese are. Is everybody sick? You know, are they all leaving the hospital? Why is everybody wearing a mask? And Jamie, it's because of pollution. It's because of particles. And at one point, this is an absolute true story, which is why, as I'm reading this, the Chinese government must have been hysterical when the explosion happened in Wuhan. And then they saw the potential for it moving across the country because they'd already created this incredibly vulnerable culture because everybody was breathing just some of the most horrific air on the planet to start. And as you pointed out in your piece, that there really is a connection to the kind of pollution you're talking about and who survives from things like asthma and other health complications. But now with COVID-19, we're gonna know exactly what's wrong because it's, you know, it's brutal, it's a beast. And if you have this underlying vulnerability, especially impacting your lungs, which is what pollution does, then you basically have almost been given a script. And the script means short life. So what was so amazing was when I first went to Shanghai to visit my daughter, it was the first time Virgin Air got on the microphone and said, we can't land in Shanghai. And I'm like, this is 2013. I'm like, we can't land in Shanghai. Why not? The pollution was so bad, Jamie, that they could not land the plane.
Wow.
Land the plane. What does that tell you? Never in Virgin Air history had they had to actually go to Beijing, which is usually worse than Shanghai, but there was some sort of inversion or whatever. But that gives you an idea of how polluted China was. And the up part of the COVID-19 is that they shut down all the factories. They shut down all the coal plants. Nobody was driving. Everybody was, you know, basically ordered to shelter in place. And my son-in-law, she's married to a young man from Shanghai, said he walked outside just about like a month ago, and it was like they could see the sky. He could breathe the air. So in an interesting way, what you're talking about is that it hits the coronavirus in such a devastating way, but yet all of a sudden people who've never experienced what air feels like when it's not full of pollution, some people may actually have that opportunity, but unfortunately they walk into this space already with health complications.
Well, and that was the question that I wondered as I talked to experts is, okay, you know, we certainly were seeing the stories coming out of China and in parts of Europe that got hit earlier than us, you know, that as shutdowns were happening, the air was noticeably cleaner. And we were starting to get some reports, you know, of that from at least some areas with a lot of traffic that you could start to notice cleaner air. And so I wondered, what impact might that have, you know, in terms of how people react to this? Are these short-term drops in air pollution, is that going to be protective? Yeah. So the experts don't know. I mean, they certainly say that helps, but they also point out that you can't take away the
damage,
right? And so so they definitely think that having less air pollution at the moment is good, because short-term air pollution can also be a problem. It can exacerbate asthma, and so, you know, if you take away that's helpful for health. They just don't know, you know, overall, you know, what's going to impact people more.
So you didn't say it, Jamie, in the title. Go on, Ken.
I was going to ask if you think, Jamie, that the COVID-19 crisis could make people who are currently climate deniers maybe more willing to accept the facts about air pollution affecting health and things like that, because it's kind of like a stain. If you take my blood and you stain it and look at it under a microscope, coronavirus is like the stain that makes the effects of air on your lungs more seeable. Is that an analogy that might make deniers more willing to accept facts?
Well, I don't know, because there's been certainly a lot of the way that people have discussed the coronavirus, it's sort of kind of across the spectrum, including people who say, it's fine. Why are we so worried about this? You know, it's like the flu, no big deal. I think one, we don't really know, what's going to happen with the pandemic we're in until we're through. And we certainly don't know what that, how that might affect people's opinions about other things. I think the one thing we can say at the moment is that, like everything else, there's disinformation about the pandemic, and maybe some of it isn't all that different from the disinformation about climate.
Okay, so let's talk about something else, because it's not in your headline, but yet it really is threaded out throughout the whole piece at both the Center for Public Integrity and Mother Jones, and that is the connection between air pollution and poor people and people of color. You kind of note that in your piece, in some ways overtly and in some ways more subtly, but that is, I think, another significant problem. Who lives near the plants that pollute? Not right. Rich people, probably not a lot of white people, but people of color, people of low income, they're forced to live in that setting. Who lives in pockets, even within the city, that are more polluted than other places? And you talk, for example, about the rate of childhood asthma in New York's central Harlem. Now, I think of New York City and I would think it's just got a bubble and every place in all of New York City sucks. But I read this and central Harlem is like a pocket of asthma. So talk to me about this.
Yeah, that's a really important question.
And part
of the reality there is that the air that you're exposed to can vary a lot, even in small areas, even with
unbelievable
in communities and cities, for instance. And that's why the fact that we just, we tend to have kind of regional air monitoring, if we have it at all in our region, makes it very hard for people to know what they're breathing. But in the case of Central Harlem, an environmental justice organization in Harlem said to me when we were talking about that is, there's what gets located in the community can matter a lot. For instance, is a highway, cutting right through the community? Are there bus depots where maybe the buses are diesel and they might need to spend a lot of time idling or driving back and forth? This really can affect people's air pollution exposure. And of course, there are some communities where there's a plant or other sort of facility that's emitting air pollutants that is.
In Harlem, that's the case, isn't it? Then the city put its plant for burning solid waste, right at 145th Street on the water. And so there's this environmental racism movement 20 years ago that was all about how that is hurting people of color who live in that area.
Where waste gets located, and particularly if it's burned, has been, linked to environmental justice issues in terms
of. Oh, good. So Jamie, I'm thinking about this is such a cocktail of failure. I mean, so we're talking about, low-income people, people of color, people living in places where it's already a toxic dump. The EPA, talking about rolling back the monitoring because of COVID-19. What you also know is if those people are living in those places, that they're suffering from pre-existing conditions like the asthma, like the everything else. What you also know is they probably don't have access to good healthcare. So they already can't care for the conditions they have. They're already not able to escape the environment in which they, basically are breathing the pollution every day. We are finding out less and less pollution still causes some significant health problems. And then you've got COVID-19 on top of that. And then you've got the EPA with that damn story coming out that says they don't have to monitor and they have excuse during COVID-19 basically to punt on these kinds of rules and regulations. It's almost like, why don't you just kill them? Because everything you've done is done to target the most vulnerable. Everything you've done is make sure not only do they live in a place where it's toxic, you don't clean up the place that's toxic, you don't give them access to a doctor, you get the rules rolled back where they're living where it's toxic, and then they have difficulty accessing a healthcare system or getting the kind of requisite income in order to either figure out how to get the doctor or frankly move out. I mean, they're captive tenants, Jamie.
Well, I mean, that's one of the things that I wanted to make sure people understood is that pollution and low income and poor health, can often end up coming together.
Yes.
It can be a trap that you're not able to move out of the area you're in, because that's the place you can afford. and you know, and that's where the pollution might be. So it's and it is a health risk. But in terms of the action that the EPA is taking, you know, one of the things that upset public health advocates is that at the same time that they're saying, you know, okay, we understand the coronavirus is a difficult situation, so companies, we're going to help you out by saying, you know, you don't have to report these things. They are not changing how they're moving forward with some of the rules that they proposed.
Tell them this part of the story. I forgot. This is the other shoe that drops, which is like, oh, because of COVID-19, we can let you roll back the monitoring, but COVID-19 doesn't apply to Jamie. Tell them the rest of the story. It's just unbelievable.
Well, so here's one example of one of those rules. The agency is considering a rule to restrict its use of scientific studies that the EPA says is about transparency, and right. that health experts say, well, this would make it far harder to set stricter pollution rules because it would restrict the kinds of studies that allow you to look at how people's health is affected by air pollution. So they've been working on this for some time, and they took comments earlier, got a whole bunch, sort of went back, you know, made some tweaks. And so they're asking for comments on this rule through sometime in April. And the National Governors Association and other groups ask them to extend comment deadlines generally because of the coronavirus, because they're swamped and local officials don't have time to respond. Right, exactly. As of now, that they're still moving forward with the same deadline.
So you can use the excuse of COVID to basically aid and abet the polluters, but then you can't use the excuse of COVID to talk about the rules and the regulations that they want to promulgate to extend it. Because let's also understand, not only are the Governors Association wanting an extension on this before they actually, you know, complete this, but the scientists that are the most knowledgeable about this are kind of preoccupied because of COVID. So they're working on trying to figure out quickly how to help the nation survive this, so they don't have the time to write the papers and to sort of object. And yet, isn't it interesting that this is kind of, you know, it's they're looking at a smorgasbord. They choose to pick this for the purposes of COVID. They choose to ignore this when it comes to COVID. And clearly the agenda is actually the same. Am I right, Jamie?
Well, I think the key is going to be to see how many comments did they get at the end of this deadline compared to the number of comments they got for the sort of the first iteration of this proposal. And I think that would be telling.
Absolutely. So before I let you go, you also, you pointed out the Harlem story. You pointed out again another place like Philadelphia, but you also tell a story of a woman who moves, I believe it was to Colorado. Why don't you sort of share a little bit about her and why you chose her? Because it sounds like she kind of started out healthy and ended up not so healthy.
Well, I mean, and I think that's really why I decided to start with her. There's a number of people in the story, and I think all of their experiences are worth reading about. In this case, this is a woman who was born in Colorado, but moved out when she was pretty young, lived most of her life in Iowa, outdoor person, loves to go out and garden, take long walks. She's got a dog who likes to take walks. Anyway, so she moved back to Colorado into an area that has high ozone levels, which is not always a visible thing. So you don't necessarily know what your air quality is. It might seem fine. She started running out of breath pretty, like within that first year of moving back, she went to a doctor, got diagnosed with asthma at age 70. And now she's 83. And so she knows she's got age and lung challenges, you know, to deal with as she's trying to protect herself from the coronavirus. And of course, on top of that, air pollution.
I wanted people to sort of hear that story. Born in Colorado, moves to Iowa, you know, basically spends all her adult life in Iowa. And actually, she's healthy. And then she moves home. And by moving home to a place where there is this, again, a little ozone's a little bit like COVID-19. It's like an invisible killer, you know what I mean? And yet it's prevalent in the environment. I mean, you think of Colorado and you think, oh, I want to move there because it's so healthy. Look what happened to her. Again, the problem with these kinds of pollutants is that you don't smell them, you don't see them, you don't taste them. But like what happened to this woman, she contracted asthma and she was in her 70s. I mean, that to me is just so shocking. You think of it as something you might get as a kid living in a polluted environment, but she returns and it turns out it didn't take very long for the pollution to impact her quality of life.
Yeah, she said it was really striking to her because she wouldn't have expected this place that's so great for getting outdoors, you know, to
yes. Which is why I wanted to bring it up, because again, people think, oh, how lucky you are. But it turns out in that environment, you are not lucky. So I want people to hear this in part because if we are still on that short timetable for not looking at scientific studies for the purposes of the EPA because they don't want to look at the science just the way Donald Trump wants to ignore the science, I think they need to understand not only should they be outraged about suspending the enforcement of environmental laws, but they should also be outraged that they haven't given a delay on this because it is unfair. If there is a problem with COVID-19, it is across the entire spectrum. And what protects us should either stay in place and then you can have the rules, you know, end up, you know, the rulemaking end at the end of April, but you can't suspend one and enforce the other because the hypocrisy is obvious. And that's exactly what they're doing right now. And that's why when I was mentioning at the very beginning, before we began our interview, I was watching MSNBC this morning and the guy that was in charge of responding after Hurricane Katrina, the general or whatever he was wild about the suspension of the environmental laws. He was wild because he understands what it means, especially for places like New Orleans, you know, especially for places like Houston. It just, these people are already compromised and now it's a license to do even more. So thank you so much for writing this. I'm glad the Center for Public Integrity has the environmental beat and Mother Jones is smart because they knew that they needed to cover this as well because these are the stories we need to sort of talk about as everyone is sort of frightened by what's happening with COVID-19. They have to understand why we're so much more vulnerable because of things like this. So thank you so much, Jamie.
Thank you for having me on.
It's a pleasure. All right, everyone. This is The Attitude with Arnie Ornison and producer Ken Barnes. We will chat demain.
One morning I woke up and I knew it all. A new day, a new way, and new eyes. Love is coming to us all.